Wait, wait, stop. That's the one.
Welcome to Zenten Speaks, a show where I make new friends and reconnect with old ones. A show where everyone's stories may inspire you to tell your own story. In this podcast, we encourage everyone to get rid of shame, guilt, fear, doubt, and judgments for themselves and for others, and replace those with love, empathy, compassion, understanding, kindness, and to do your best in everything that you do. In essence, to get rid of things that no longer serve your well-being, to be true to yourself and be honest with others.
Yeah, okay, cool. I'm so excited for you to be here. I'm so grateful for you. Thank you.
Thank you for having me here. I'm very excited. A little nervous, but excited.
Today we have a guest. Our guest today is Sam Williams. Sam and I met on Facebook group called Sober Tribes Vibe Recovery and Support Group. Sam was sober until she relapsed in September 2021, but she got back on her feet and back on track. And so Sam is currently taking classes to be a peer support specialist. And I'm very happy for you to be here. And I'm very blessed that you give us our time. And I'm very proud of you that you're going to be a peer support person and
yeah.
That you're back on track. Because I've noticed a lot of people when they relapse, they feel bad. But at the same time, you know, you're human beings. We're going to stumble. And the best thing we can do is we can just pick ourselves back up and keep doing what we need to do, right?
Exactly. When you relapse, there's a lot of shame that comes with that, a lot of guilt that comes with that. But you got to remember, you're only human. And the only way to prove that you're not, you know, a failure in any sort of way is to get back up on that horse. It is hard. It is painful. But I believe that anybody can do it.
Definitely. Do you know Dr. Wayne Dyer?
Who?
Dr. Wayne Dyer. He's an
inspirational speaker.
So I will send you a link. But Dr. Wayne Dyer is one of my gurus. He passed away a couple of years ago, but he says that there is no such thing as failure. You know why? Because we are in this human, we're spirits in this human body, and we're doing the best we can. And the only way you fail is if you are attached to the outcome, because we don't know what the future is. But if you're living in the present, and if you're aware of what's happening now, you're living in the present and you're doing your best, you can never fail. Because how can you fail when you don't know what the future is, right? So that's the thing for myself. I don't fail like when I talk to myself, because that word comes with, like, you know, baggage. When you fail, there's a shame about it. And there is a fear that you're going to do it again. But if you just take that out of your vocabulary, then you're just living life and there's no more fear, there's no more shame. And I'm glad that you mentioned that there's shame that comes to that, but you know, you're going to do your best and shame hell with it, right?
Yeah, but like at some point you're going to have to sit there and be like, yeah, I feel horrible about this, but you know what? If you have the support that you need, if you have friends, family, therapists, support groups, you know, you can get back on it, because everyone at some point or another has been where you're at that moment, you know? So I completely agree with what your mentor has said, and I am sorry for his passing.
Yeah, definitely. I had my other mentor is Susie Orman. She's a financial guru. And I think she mentioned that she was a big person. She's a big financial guru, like most of the world knows her. And she, even herself, she stumbled like at her old age, knowing all the things she knew. And it humbled her though, because when you stumble and then you basically people know you as a certain way and then you see yourself as a certain way. And when you stumble, it humbles you, shows you that, yeah, you're great, but then keep your mindset of like, yeah, I'm great, but shit can happen. And the best thing you can do is pick yourself back up.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. I agree with that.
Yes, so as you may know, in all my interviews, I ask the first question is, tell us about who you are and what brings you joy.
All right. Well, I'm Sam. I am a mom of two wonderful, terrific kids. I live in Lincoln, Nebraska. I am a semi-artist, and I want to preach, but I am an advocate for mental health, and I have been in somewhat of the community with it probably for like the last few months. Part of that was I live not too far from a rehab facility, so I see a lot of people on the streets, and I'm always there talking to them when it looks like they're having a rough time, or I'm giving them pamphlets full of information and resources. Lincoln has great programs, but I don't feel like there's enough outreach, so I kind of went out on my own to do it, and then I
Wow.
found out about peer support, and I decided to go ahead and do that.
Yeah.
What brings me joy is seeing other people succeed, seeing other people, cheering them on and cheering my kids on and walking in nature. That is my biggest joy I have right there.
That's so beautiful. Wow. So you saw your gift, so you're going full on it. That's perfect.
Yeah. Thank you.
Wow. So what are your shame, guilt, and fear, and how are you working on overcoming those? Or if you have overcome them, how did you do it?
A lot of my shame and my guilt has been my trauma. I grew up a very traumatic childhood, a very traumatic teenagehood, and a very traumatic marriage. And I felt very shamed and guilty for all the things that had happened. And it took me years of therapy to realize that, none of that was my fault, that I had no reason to be shamed of that or feel guilty for that because I did what I needed to do to survive at that time. So, I mean, those are my, and what was the other part? I'm sorry.
Yes, shame, guilt, and fear.
My biggest fear is relapsing and going back to who I was before I started this journey. From 14 to 19, I did nothing but drink and did drugs and partied, and I was kind of a crappy person towards other people at the time, which went really against what I believed in my religious area. So my biggest fear is going back to that, even though I am aware that I have had so much growth that it's impossible to go back to that for me.
Yeah. And you probably heard of that word, what you focus on will persist. So, with the shame, and you probably even experienced that because I even experienced when I'm shameful about certain things or when I'm feel guilty about certain things, and especially when you're fearful, those emotions, anything in life is just is. Those emotions are there to guide you temporarily as a crush, as in a sense. Like fearful of maybe asking a girl for a date or something like that. Yeah, but you can feel okay, I'm fearful. Why? You ask yourself questions and then you interrogate yourself and you can see how you can do better. And then you get the courage to go and do it. But if you're just living in fear, then you're never gonna have the courage to do it. And you're gonna have shame about yourself. Then you start asking, oh, am I not pretty enough or my skills and all this stuff? Then you're gonna have shame and guilt and all this other crap that you don't really need. While any emotions, even sweet emotions, are there to say, hey, this is it's like an awareness, and then for you to act upon it. And so I don't remember exactly the quote, but it says that courage is not a lack of fear. Like you have courage, you still do it, but you do it fearfully, kind of with that. I killed a crow, but
No, I get it. There's a quote I know of, and I don't remember who said it, but it's like, if it scares you, do it.
yes.
So, I mean, that's what I live by. I mean, when I had my relapse this year, I was scared that I would not be a proper peer support specialist. But you know what? There's therapists out there who have mental health problems and addiction problems, and they still get back on it. They still go out there and help other people. And I realize if they can do that, then I can do that. And I just need to work on myself as well as helping others.
And I think you're the perfect person to do it because you went through it. You have the mm-hmm. empathy. I went through depression one time, first time in my life last year. I mm-hmm. understood scientifically or psychologically, and I have compassion and kindness toward people with depression. But I being truthful, I couldn't tell you I had the empathy because I didn't have their shoes. Like, I get mm-hmm. it, but then I would have the pep talk. Yeah, but you know, you can da 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 da. But if you're going to depression, you don't want to really, you know that, but you don't want to hear that. But when I went through that depression, I'm like, you know what? I understand why when you're being depressed, you don't want to be hearing the inspirational talk. You don't want someone keep telling you, oh, you can do it. It gets better. Da, da, da. You want the empathy. You want someone to be there with you and hold your hand and caress you and hug you and validate you and see you. But yes. I did not, like, being truthful, I did not have those skills until I went there. Mm-hmm. So yep. you went there. So you are the perfect, of course, someone else who never had that, they probably can still do it, but you give that little extra that someone else who went through it. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. And one of the criteria of being a peer support specialist is lived experience. Mm. So, I mean, the program really does look for people who have had addictions and mental health problems in the past and currently working on that, or, you know, at that place where they can do it. When I went through my interview for it, they asked a lot of questions about my personal life and what I went through. And even though I know I went through it, it was still kind of hard to talk about because I hadn't really talked about it other than among my therapists and the people who sat there and watched me go through it. So, I mean, they really do look for that. A lot of the peer support and recovery advocate positions here, they want you to have that experience because they understand that you know what it's like and you know how to kind of navigate through what that other person is going through.
Certainly. And most people like to know they're not alone. And most yes. people like to know they understood or you feel them. Mm-hmm. And it comes from your heart too, because I feel that it's coming from your heart. I feel it, the energy. You're not like, oh, I can't make $100,000, so let me go for the money.
But it's definitely not about the money. I think I looked up what the wages were once for peer support, and it's anywhere between $26,000 and $30,000 a year. And honestly, I don't even care about that. I just want to be there for the person. Before I finally went into therapy, which is a very, that right there was an interesting process. But before I went to therapy, you know, I didn't want to reach out to anybody. I didn't think anyone would understand where I came from. I didn't think anyone would understand my thought process or understand me at all. So, I mean, that was my big push when I got into therapy and I got into sober living, more back into sober living, because I've been on and off of it through most of my 20s. And I knew that's something I wanted to do immediately. Like, I don't care about the funds. I can always find a way around it. I'm frugal as heck. I just want to be there and try my best to help others and create more of an outreach within our area.
Mm-hmm. So, tell me how you are feeling when you posted that you relapse, what you are feeling and what you wanted to get out of that from people.
What I was feeling at that moment was, because that was really rough. It was my first New Year's Eve sober. Even during the times where I was sober, I still had at least a drink on New Year's Eve. So this was my first New Year's Eve where I didn't have a drink. I didn't have anyone around me at that time. And I felt very guilty again, that guilt and shame. It came back up to the surface and I was like, I just need someone to hear me. I just need someone to know that I just need to know that I'm not alone in this, that it's normal. It's not normal, but it's, you know,
right.
It's there. So for me, it was just wanting the outreach of other people and try to find other people who have been there and understand where I was coming from. Because I have a lot of sober friends. I cut out all my friends who were still drinking and doing drugs. So, I mean, my sober friends, they get it, but they don't get it. And I couldn't contact my old friends because it could open a door of possibility of relapsing again. So, I mean, that was my main thing about posting in the group. I just wanted to meet somebody, talk to somebody, anybody at that moment. And this one thing they don't tell you about sobriety, when you first get back it doesn't matter what phase you get back on it, or you're just starting, or, you know, anything like that. When you get back into sobriety, it is very lonely at first. So, and you know, I tried other groups and they weren't quite working out for me. And I ended up finding the group that you and I are both in. And it's just, it's an amazing group. I love them.
Nice. Having support in the right surrounding is definitely great. And so I wanted to ask you, because I've noticed one thing about people who are using and they stop using, and then they left those friends who are still using. And but while you were in there, I don't know about you and can tell me if it was the same for you, but I know a lot of people, while they were in there, having supportive friends was really important for them. And they didn't want people to leave them. But once someone gets sober, like they were that way, once they get sober, then they start leaving people. Have you thought about that? Or because I would love to understand that process.
Okay, so one example about that was recently I had a really good friend. I mean, I loved her to death. We were best friends, like the matching outfits type of best friends, you know. The problem with that was is that she was also an addict. And she, I wasn't going to say she brought me into it, but we definitely enabled each other. And it got to the point where she got physically violent with me back at the end of October. And I ended up cutting ties at that point. And that's when I officially realized no matter what, I couldn't be around my friends who were still using. So I still kept in contact with them for a while, but I realized when I was with them, it was harder to stay sober. It was harder to not smoke marijuana. It was just, and those were my two things, was drinking and cannabis. And it was just really, really hard. And when you lose those friends, you know, it is almost like a death because you know you can't go in contact with them. You want the best for them. You wish the best for them. But for you and your own health, you have to do what you need to do. When my friend attacked me, that was it. I was done. I was like, okay, she is not going to go on the sober train with me because we had spoke about it a couple of times before. I go, I can't do this. And, you know, it's sad. I miss her. I wish her the best. But, you know, there's a lot of situations like that with a lot of people. You know, there's just some people who, I don't want to say holds your hand down the wrong road, kind of drags you down the wrong road. But at the same time, if their energy isn't right, if their mindset isn't right, they will take anyone with them. And, you know, I had a few friends like that over the years. And each time I'd snap out of it and I'd be like, oh, run, this is what's going on. And I have to cut ties. It hurts. I'm not going to lie. It does hurt. But you need to do what you need to do for you.
And so the quote, when it says that the company that you in influences you, so that's definitely true in your case or true in life?
Yeah, I believe it's very true in life. You are who your tribe is, in a sense. So, I mean, I know people who are sober and have been always been sober who can hang around people who do that. That's great. I'm proud of them, you know, but there's other people like in my case, who we can't do that. Like we can't be around those people anymore. And a lot when I did cut ties with some of the friends, I've had mixed reactions. I've had very angry people and I've had very good people who are like, okay, honey, I love you. I wish you the best. And I hope you grow. And I'm like, I hope you grow too. It doesn't make them a bad person. It's just, you can't, when you're an addict, you can't be around those influences, especially if they're constantly smoking or they're constantly drinking or they invite you to parties. And that's really hard because for my example, I have social anxiety. So when I'm at a party, that's when I want to drink more because I'm around all these people and I don't know what to do. I don't know how to handle it. It's taken me a few years in therapy to learn how to. And I usually just make appearances now. I stay around for about 30 minutes, an hour, and then I leave before anyone starts really drinking. And that's how I handle that.
That's great. Wow. I have been sober most of my life and being the straight edge person. But because I also have a religious background where Jesus hung out with the prostitute, the thieves, tax collector and all this stuff. So I wanted to be like Jesus. So I had all these kind of friends. And because I determined to be sober and not use things, but I've noticed a pattern that was happening is though my true friends, they were not in the beginning, of course, it would be like, are you sure you don't want to do it? Are you sure? Are you sure? they would not pressure me, but they would like keep asking. Yeah, so those friends, in the beginning, of course, as people get to know me, they wouldn't pressure me, but you know how it is. Are you sure you don't want to bump? Are you sure you don't want to sip? And things like that. And I'll be like, no, I'm good. Because I was like pretty strong at that. And then, but I've noticed one thing though, and that's why I cut them off. People who are using, they were stealing my shit all the time. And because I'm that friend is, I strongly believe, I'm not promoting people to steal my shit, but I strongly believe that I do not own, even things you see me back of me, I worked, I bought them, but I do not own anything. Because when I die, they can put clothes on me, but not even my body is mine. I'm a spirit, I'm gonna die. So therefore, if someone steals something from me, I strongly believe that if you needed it that bad and you took it, it must have been yours to begin with. Mm-hmm. But and then they know that. So you know how people are. They abuse certain things. So, and then, you know, when they said the straw that breaks their camel's back, like I'm pretty patient and strong about that. But then they do it enough and I had to cut ties with these people. And they're like, well, I thought you were giving. And I was like, yeah, but so much I can give. Like, come on. I don't work 40 hours to like give you 60% of my pay. Like I'm generous, but come on. Another thing too is when they get shit faced, I had to take care of them, which I did not mind. But again, the last straw that breaks the camel's back, like what more do you need from me? Like I'm trying to be Jesus, but I don't want to be Jesus, you know, like don't yeah. take advantage of me. And so, and another third thing is they would often fight all the time. And I had to be the sober person to like get into it and be like, stop, whatever. Oh, and the fourth thing is a lot of them, when we go shopping, I didn't know this and I'm glad I didn't get caught up with it. They would shoplift and I had no idea. And I heard if someone's shoplifting and you're with them, you get in trouble too. And that so later on, later on, I was just like, you know what? I'm sorry. Like if you're not self-aware or if you're not gracious enough to be like, okay, I'm with this person and they're my friend and they're not doing all the shit I'm doing and you're not aware enough to not get me in trouble, I'm sorry. Like I love you so much, but it's not reciprocal. So I gotta go. And yep. So those are the four reasons why I left.
Yeah, and I completely agree with you. When I was drinking, I would be very emotional. It was not hard for me to start an argument. I remember one time, some context, there was drama behind it just before I got drunk, but I tried to hotwire my car and I had to be pulled out of my car and I fought and I kicked and I screamed and it was not a behavior that was me normally. So I mean, I agree with that. Shoplifting, I never did. My big thing was borrowing money and never paying it back. And now as a sober person, it's something I'm trying to do. I'm trying to get in contact with people that I did borrow money from. Like, hey, you know that money I borrowed from you? Here you go. I'm sorry. I'm sorry to take
this. That's so nice of you. Because most people just hope you forget.
Yeah, no. No, that's where guilt comes in again. I feel guilty about it. And like I feel like the only way I can heal for that situation is to try to give it back, to try to help what way I can. So I mean, I never shoplifted. I've been around people who shoplifted. My sibling, who is an addict, a current addict, she is a shoplifter and she is. There's times she did it so much, I didn't even know she did it. And she's just pulling things out of her bag. And I'm like, what?
Yeah, you know? We're hanging out. I had people like, with coats. And I'm like, wait a minute. Like, how do you have this $1,000 coat on you? And I was just like, oh, I missed where they swished it. I had no idea. They're that good.
But yeah, like me, I forget to pay for batteries at checkout and I start coming back and going, I'll pay for it. Sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think different addictions make you do different things. It takes your shadow self and pulls it out. in a non-balanced way. So I have watched some friends who are addicts just do things that would completely add to their character, but because they were on whatever they were on at that time, it turned them into that person. So, I mean, it's rough to see it go through, and it's rough when you watch yourself go through it, but it makes you more aware, so you know how to stop in the future.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I tell anybody who's going to watch this, and even my old friends, like, I never judge them. I love them. But as mm-hmm. we know, we have to love ourselves first. Because if I don't love myself, then I cannot love you properly. So I need to remove myself in the self-destructive relationship. Because if you shit-face all the time, it's like, how is that good for me? If you shoplift mm-hmm. and I get in trouble, how is that good for me? Like, and I understand they're probably not able to ask those questions because they're under the influence. But once you're sober, you got to be like, okay, Zen didn't leave because he hated whoever, da-da-da. It's not that at all. Because I love anybody. I love a homeless person on the street. Actually, as I mentioned, I grew up religious and I love to basically emulate Mother Teresa or Jesus. Even Mother Teresa, I think there was a quote where she said that they're like, how you treat everybody the same, says, because anyone I meet, I see Jesus in them. Because if Jesus is your master, so you're going to see everyone else like him. So therefore you're going to see them with that high respect. So of course, as when I was religious, I did that, but now it's like, it's so natural for me. I'm like, you know how many people on the street, they're like, at first they hit me up. And then when I stop to hear what they say, they like, forget whatever reason they stopped me for. They're like, actually, I want to say thank you for stopping and see a human in me. They don't want to ask me for money anymore. They don't want to sell me drugs anymore. They just want to acknowledge I stopped, look at them in the eye, and at least hear what they want to say. And I have the choice to say, I don't have money, and I'm sorry, I can't give you money, or I'm not buying this drug, I'm not into that, whatever. And I, even with that, I don't say with an attitude like, at all. I give them respect. And when I stop and give them that respect, they're like, oh my God. Like, and when I lived in Boston, I had a lot of homeless and youth, people who use friends. They see them on the street. Mm-hmm. It's funny, I walk with my friends and I'm saying hi to everybody. People are stopping on the street and talking to me. And they're like, how you know that person? Like, because I live a different kind of life. And they're like, how are you with, because I don't see people as high or low. Everyone's equal, whatever. But of course, mm-hmm. you know, society, they're like, how are you this level? And then you talking to that person, like, how did you meet that person? And I'm like, I'm in Boston. Like, I'm walking down the street. I'm on the train. I see people. I talk to people. I see people as human beings. So that's how I know them.
Yep.
And yeah. Yeah.
I do what I call exploration of the downtown. I live not too far from downtown. So when it's nice out, I take walks all over downtown, and you'll run into homeless people. You'll run into people who are just barely making it by. You'll run into other addicts. You run into all these different people, and I love sitting and talking to them. I want to know where they're coming from. I yeah. want to know them. But when it does come to a point of, hey, do you have money? Hey, do you have this? I'm like, I'm sorry, I can't. You know, I'm almost in the same boat as you, unfortunately.
Right.
I'll listen to your story and I will listen to you. I've had many a times where we're walking downtown and people will be playing, you know, busting it and trying to sell jewelry and things like that. And it'd be like, I can't help you, but I want to know more about you. Like, what can we do to get you the resource to help you? I mean, I know you need money right now. I can't do that, but you know, there's, you know, this program here, here and here. Let's try to get you in contact with them in some way. And I write down their numbers and I give it to them all the time. And I try to help them in that sense. But at the same time, they're so interesting. Like their stories, them, their personalities, their souls.
And they're like, nice people. They're the nicest people I know.
People ever. And like, yeah. I most people won't give these people a hug, and I hug them. I'm like, oh my God, come here and give me a hug. So, I mean, it's, I love it. I love that there's people who are so open and willing to talk and, you know, try to find, you know, and willing to open up to another person, because when you're in that situation, you don't want to open up half the time. You don't want people to know because you're embarrassed or ashamed of it.
Right. Right.
And I just love being able to be there for them in some way.
Right. Definitely. I love that. I'm so rooting for you. And I'm so proud of you. And as you mentioned in your opening statement, like, you're happy when people are happy and you're happy for their success. And when you said, I was like, oh my God, it's like you speaking with my tongue. Cause I feel the same way too. When you wrote that you studying to be a peer support specialist. And I was like, oh my God, I'm so happy. Like you doing that. I totally feel you. So what was your childhood like?
Extreme poverty, honestly. I grew up in the backwoods of Missouri in the Ozarks. we lived in a rickety old trailer. We could feel the wind blow through in the winters. But we were almost self-sustaining in a sense. We had our own garden. We had our own cows. We had, you know, all this other stuff. My mother is an alcoholic. So there was a lot of mental abuse going on with that most of my life. We moved up and most of the time I wasn't even home. I was living with my friends, you know, quote unquote, living with them. One of my best friends, I stayed with her for 6 months in, what was I, like 10? And then when I was 12 to 13, I lived with her for a year. And then we moved up here to Nebraska, my eighth grade year. And that's when I started drinking and I was kicked out by the time I was 14. And I would couch surf between my sisters, my friends, my coworkers while trying to go through high school, dealing with an alcohol problem that I wasn't really aware that I had. And I just was stuck in survival mode. But because, you know, once you start an abuse, when you grow up in abuse, you almost get stuck in that cycle. So throughout my, you know, childhood, my teenage years, and even into my 20s, I was in this abuse cycle. And I didn't break out of that until 2014. And then it took me years after that to break out of that mentality that, you know, I need to be around people like this because that's how I grew up. It was very rough. There's a lot of times where we didn't have food. There was times where I got my siblings' hand-me-downs that didn't fit at all. But, you know, you do what you had to do when you grew up in poverty. I remember there was a time my mom was gone for almost a week. And all we had was school lunches and banana nut bread mix for dinner. It was very, very rough. Not, you know, people are like, oh, you lived your cottage core dreams. You ran out in the woods. I'm like, no, we ran out in the woods because we were looking for wild strawberries. Like, it wasn't that great.
Wow. So, and you say 8 years old when you started alcohol?
I was in eighth grade. I was 13, 14 years old. I was invited to a party by some of the country kids and I got introduced to UV vodka, I think it was. And that was my choice of drink throughout high school. And then I would go from vodka to beer, beer to vodka. By the time I was 18, I was drinking Jaeger straight. I had no filter when it came to my alcohol. And then by the time I was 18, 19 years old, I was doing ecstasy. I was doing coke. I was drinking. I was just going full out partying. And it wasn't until I had a one night stand and got pregnant with my oldest daughter was when I decided I needed to quit. And I stayed sober from It was September 2007 until, I want to say it was like July 2015. And that's when I got out of my divorce and I was like, we're going to party it up. And, you know, I was the type of friend where other friends gave alcohol for their birthday gift. So I ended up with rum. I ended up with vodka. I ended up with Jaeger, all these other shots and drinks. And when the boyfriend at the time was at work, he had no clue that I was going over to the little mart by our house and getting shots and putting it in my soda and going to work. And I did that. And then, 2016 is when I got back on cannabis and I could smoke an ounce in a week. I had no problem just smoking. And then, I realized my drug and alcohol habits were connected to my bipolar disorder. So, when I was manic, I did it more than anything, especially drinking. And then when I was depressed, I smoked more to try to bring myself up. And then, I had a very major episode from 2016 to 2017. I just kept repping cycling, just in and out, in and out, in and out. And finally, in 2018, I quit and I went to therapy and I stayed sober off alcohol. Cannabis I reduced on a lot until this year. And then I completely relapsed on both of them for a couple of months, from September to November.
What was the trigger for relapsing?
There is a lapse in my medications and my insurance. So I was off my medications and I went manic, and then I'd get depressed and then I'd go manic, and my mania would last anywhere between 2 to 3 weeks, and my depression would last about 2 to 3 weeks. And it was just really hard to try to get balanced. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, at the time I had a friend who was also enabling it, and I was enabling her. And when I finally stopped cycling, I was like, okay, you got to stop. There's no just one drink. You're a binge drinker. You got to stop. And that's when I also realized that I really did have a problem with cannabis, despite myself saying, oh, it's just cannabis. You can't get addicted to cannabis. Oh, yes, you can. And so I just quit them both completely. It's been an interesting road.
So it has many benefits. It has health benefits as well as saving your money.
Yes. Oh my gosh. I was so broke all the time. Like, I was sitting here going, okay, I can get this pre-roll for $5. And at that point it was Delta 8, which is legal here in the state of Nebraska. We have a dispensary that sells it. And I was like, okay, so if I pull money from this account and my change right here, I might be able to get, and you're just sitting there and you're just constantly thinking about it. And I never realized I was that bad, because, you know, I did have we'll call them a situationship. I had a situationship who would just provide it. And I didn't even realize that. And then once I told him, once we sat down and talked, and I was like, I'm an addict, we can't do this anymore. And he's like, that's fine. And he's actually turned into one of my biggest supporters. I was just over at his house when I first got sober, and I was like, I could smell his bag. And I was like, you know, why don't I just have one hit? And he's like, no. I'm like, just a baby one, just one. And he's like, no, you're trying to better yourself. I'm not going to let you do that.
That's nice. Wow. That's great. It's also good, as we mentioned earlier, have the right surroundings and the right people with us who's going to support us. And I had my first try of things last year, 20, what month was that? I don't remember which month, but 2020, like between August and December, probably, I tried a lot of things because I fell into trauma bond with a guy, and he was an addict. He was basically an addict, but he's denying it. And I believe that, because I didn't know all this stuff in deeply. I'm thinking, oh, maybe I didn't know what denial was, because I'm thinking if you say you can manage it and it's okay to manage whatever. And so I wanted to get close to him. So I did stuff that he was doing. And then I went into depression and like very badly, because I was hanging out with the wrong crowd and basically doing what they're doing. He didn't force me or anything, but I made that mistake in my life. And back then I was like having shame and guilt and beating myself down, but now I don't anymore, because I see it as a learning lesson, and that I stumbled and I learned from it, et cetera. And I see the pattern of, like, I've noticed like an energy thing. Most energies that are depleting, negative or heavy usually pull you down. Cause if you're light, it'll pull the light stuff down. The heavyweight will put it down. It's rarely that something heavy will go up to the light, something that's floating light. And so I had to learn that. I was like, wow, like I was easily pulled. I think it was easy because we were in trauma bond or in love. But when it comes to my friends, I was pretty strong. I was like, nope. I was in a different kind of love with my friends. I love you, but not this much to actually do it. So I totally learned that. Yeah. Wow. So... Yep. So when you were doing it in eighth grade, and as you mentioned, maybe because it was your surroundings, so it was like, it seems like a normal thing. So you didn't think about that drugs were bad or?
Well, at that time, you know, the woman I considered my mother died just a year before. I'd lost my best friend, who was practically my sister. And then we moved. I wasn't even aware we were moving. I thought we were just coming up here to visit my brother. we're halfway up here. My mom said, by the way, we're going to live in Dorchester now. And I'm like, what? So like, I had a lot of trauma and a lot of change and no one there to listen to me. And it was just a way to not feel it, you know, feel something else, you know, that, and that's what mainly got me to do it, you know? And, it was also a learned behavior of coping with emotions with alcohol. Cause that's what I learned from my mother, from watching her. And, so it was just all that put together that really got me started. I'm like, well, if mom does this and my sisters do this, then I can do this and it'll be fine. And then by the time I was a junior in high school, I was sneaking screwdrivers into the school. Like nobody, I mean, my friends knew because they knew me well enough to know that in that Tropicana bottle was also vodka. So it had gotten to a point where I needed it to function in the morning. Sometimes, there'd be days I wake up, pop open a beer that, you know, I convinced my 21-year-old then boyfriend, oh my gosh, right, to buy me. And I would just drink a beer before I go to school while getting ready. Or, you know, it was literally every weekend I would get drunk and I would do it like, and I did, and it was weird because I'm so high functioning. I was in drama. I was in speech. I was a school paper. I was in choir. I was working. I was going to school and I was such a high functioning alcoholic. I didn't realize how bad it was until I became a mother. And I didn't want my kids to see that. And that's a number one rule I have and always kept. My kids will never see me drink. And to this day, they have not.
That's great. That's wonderful. I've spoken to a lot of people and I love that how as soon as, well, usually we're men I've spoken to a lot. And I'm sure it happened, as you mentioned, with females that as soon as a child that came in, they're like, okay, I got to live for my child. Mm-hmm. And I love how, yes, you're going to live for something outside of you. And I think eventually I would hope they also want to live for themselves as well, which is important.
I call it the anchor. My kids are definitely my anchor. And over the years, I have worked on creating my own anchor. I mean, I have teenagers now. They're about to go into high school and it's only a few years before they leave the nest. And I'm going to have to learn that, you know, they can't just always be my anchor. I have to develop my own. Yes. And that's something I've been working on very hard over the last few years. Like 2021 was a big change for me. It was my first time without roommates. It was my first time without a boyfriend or a girlfriend or a husband or anybody in my life living with me. So I really had to learn how to function and live alone while raising my kids. And then realizing that I am my own self-worth. I am my own anchor and I can do this without that.
That's great. Wow. That's so wonderful. That's very important. I'm so happy for you.
Thank you.
To get into that. And I know it's tough and it's in the toughness that we grow. And so that's great. So you've gone to AA and NA?
I tried. Okay. This is, I'm one of the few people who don't do that. I tried. I really, really did. But I just couldn't connect with everybody there. I really felt like I have nothing against Christians. A lot of my friends are Christians, but I don't like the idea of feeling like you have to be Christian. And that's kind of in this area, that's kind of the idea they put out. In this area, they do. It really does feel like in this area. I mean, we're Nebraska. I mean,
right.
That right there explains itself. but I'm pagan. So what I do is I should have brought it over, but I have what I call a cravings jar. And with it is non-alcoholic wine, a cigarette bud, and a pre-roll bud, and cinnamon and pepper. And I use that for my craving. So if I'm craving an alcoholic drink or if I'm craving like, oh my gosh, a joint would be so good right now, I just shake that bottle and I focus on it. And I focus on what life would be like without it. And it helps me relieve that. It could be spicy psychology. It could be magic. For me, it works. So I do that.
Yeah, if it works, it works.
Yeah, it works. So, I mean, my therapist is very happy that I've done that. So,
yeah, great. I guess sugar craving, that's my addiction battle that I have personally. And a couple times, I did relapse and I went to get two bags of Oreos. And then, of course, the first five were tasty. And then as I'm looking at, because they were on sale for $2 for $5, and I was like, bingo. And as I was like half on, because you know, they come in three rows. As I'm on like the first or half of it, and I was like, ew, that's gross. And then I was like, damn, I have to finish this whole thing now because it's in the house. I have to finish it. And I was oh my God.
I get that. Because before I quit smoking cannabis, I'm going to have so many cannabis smokers about to fall over after I say this. I'm like, oh gosh, I got an ounce. I got to finish this before I quit. You know, it'd just be a waste if I could do it. And then I'm like, no. And I picked it up.
Yeah.
And I threw it in the dumpster with my pipe and everything. I was just like, nope, we're done. And I was like, you do it now or you're not going to do it at all.
That's
and
true.
it was my Oreo moment.
Oh my God, you're strong. I couldn't do it with my Reese's. I was like, okay, this is my last Reese's Pieces.
Yeah, but no, I get it. That's like me and coffee too. Cause like coffee's a trigger for me to smoke. So I had to quit drinking coffee. Like, I get it. I totally get it.
Well, I was strong enough to do it with my candy corn. I like candy corn, but not enough.
Right.
So I threw it all in. I have a compost bin. So I put it in the compost bin. And like, don't get me wrong, I was tempted to go back in there. But I was like, I put it in something gross enough so I won't be like, ew, like, how low can I get?
So I thought about going back in that dumpster. You know what I did? I dumped my litter box on top of it.
Yeah.
I'm like, no, we're not doing that. Like, it was so rough. Like, I could, and like, to this day, I still can't believe I did that. And like, I tell a couple of my friends who are the occasional smokers, the ones who don't force it on you, who won't smoke around you, who like just do it, you know, to go to bed or kind of thing. And they fall over. They're like, we can't believe you did that. I go, I can't believe I did that.
They're like, you could have called me and given it to me.
Like, why didn't you give it to me? That's exactly what I got. I was like, why didn't you give it to me? I go, because if I didn't get rid of it that moment, I was never going to stop.
Yes,
like
exactly.
That was my now or never moment, you know? And I feel like everybody has that moment. And when you have that moment, you literally have to do it at that time or you're not.
Yes. Yes.
So for me, that was my moment. And I cried a little inside of my whole eye. Like that was an ounce that I put in dumpster on top of litter, but I did it. And I definitely don't really regret it. I still kind of laugh that I did it in the way I did. Cause like, I literally just jumped off my bed and ran out my apartment to do it.
Right. Yes, most certainly. I don't smoke weed, but I had a certain point of my life. I have a luck about certain things. I would find weeds in little baggies all the time. And then I don't smoke them. What I did is I put them, because I have a lot of plants. So I put them in the, because I like the smell of it, but I don't smoke it. So I put it in the plant pots. And when I had people come over, they'd be like, wow, like you got weed. And then once someone, I'm like, I don't have weed. They're just in my plants. And they're like, you're crazy. Who does that? And I like the smell, but I don't want to smoke it myself. And
I would have looked in the plant. I would have been like, is it right there? Oh, okay.
Oh, yeah, they do. They do. And some have gone through the dirt to be like, oh, I see a little bit of it. I'm like, whatever. Yeah. So have you seen, are you seeing a therapist or have you?
Yeah, I actually started therapy in 2018. I am going through a really good therapist now. I kind of had a switch in therapists over the years because, you know, some of them moved on to another job or moved to another school, moved to another state to finish their schooling, you know, that kind of thing. But I've had this current therapist for almost 2 years. When I started therapy, you had to go in at a certain time and it was a first come, first serve to sign up. That's how the program worked. And it seemed like no matter how early I came in, I was always not able to get in. So finally, one day, I was going to press mixed episode. I couldn't take it anymore. And I sat down and I said, I'm not leaving until you get me or I'm going to kill myself. And that's exactly what I said. And I sat in there for about 30 minutes and my then therapist came out and he's like, all right, let's talk. And that was that. I started on meds again. I've been in therapy consistently. I'm starting EMDR, which is a form of therapy to help with PTSD. And I haven't looked back when it came to that part. I'm very thankful for the services that I get through the clinic that I go to.
I'm glad you're seeing a therapist, because as you probably know, there's all this stigma about it. If you've seen it, you must be broken. You must have all these things going on for you. I mean, like, who doesn't? You know, right? It's like, who doesn't have trauma? Who doesn't have things that's broken with them? And therapy, you're trying to fix all of that. You're trying to find yourself. You're trying to do better. So why is there that stigma? I just don't get it. It's like, if you're not seeing a therapist and you're just in the closet of beating yourself down and in shame, that's like worse than seeing a therapist.
Well, and see, and that stigma has it's been getting better over the last couple of years. I definitely see the stigma getting, you know, erased. But it all comes from, you know, the 16, 1700s when they were locking up lunatics in chains and leaving them there. And it just evolved from that to lobotomies to, oh, you have the baby blues, you're going to be locked up for the rest of your life. And so there, because of the consequences of back then, you know, that stigma has just grown and it's made more people feel like they couldn't come out. But it's something I definitely seen over the years, that a lot of people are coming out with their traumas, with their mental health issues and things like that. And more people are saying therapy works. It's there. You know, you need therapy, you need support. And a lot of the programs here, you don't just have therapy. You have your community support worker, you have your med management team. You have all that there with you. And one thing I do is definitely share my experiences about my mental illness. I do have a TikTok, and on it, I will record myself if I'm manic, just to show what mania is like. If I'm depressed, I will show what my depression is like. If I'm going through a PTSD moment, I will record it and show it just to say, hey, you're not alone. I'm here. I'm doing it too. And, you know, you're okay. You are safe and you're in a safe place and we will get you there. Mm-hmm. So it's definitely a stigma that I am not a fan of, and I definitely will fight against. I mean, a lot of people use the term crazy. Even I let it slip and say crazy, but personally, I don't like the word. Like, you're ill. Okay. It's like, if you broke your leg, you wouldn't expect to go to work the day you broke your leg, or work, you know, depending what type of work you do. If you got a desk job, okay. But if you're doing a manual job, like I used to do, you know, you wouldn't expect to go to work on that. So why would you expect to go to work when you're mentally not feeling well either? You know, you got to treat it just as equal as a physical illness, you know, and I see a lot of people starting to do that. I do see some companies. So like, if you need a mental health day, let us know, you know, we'll work with you.
Wow, and that's great.
Some of them. Yeah. And there's some companies here where I've seen that with, one of my friends is working for a student loan collector, and they're definitely helping her out with that. And then I worked for, I was a CNA, and they worked with me on that with my bipolar disorder. And it's just something I've definitely seen grown over the last few years, as compared to where you have an anxiety attack and they tell you to go home, you're fired. So, I mean, which is definitely has happened to me in the past.
Wow. Wow. Yeah, that's really important, because people forget about mental health. And if they know about it, they just, as you mentioned, they just call it, they write you out saying you're crazy, and let's get that person fired. Let's dismiss them. They're low lives and all this crazy stuff. But it's like, well, like you're saying, it's like an illness of anything else. And I'm glad, well, because of COVID, as of last year, we're still in it, that even the common cold, people want you to go home now. And I'm like, see, now they're, what's that word? They're taking illnesses seriously.
It's taken a few hundred years, but it's finally happening. That happening, especially with elder millennials, I call them bosses. They definitely see it. And then you're starting to see it with the Gen Z, like they are totally for that, and they're starting to grow on that too. So I definitely have hope like in the next 10 to 20 years is that that stigma will be gone, both mentally, mental illness and physical illness, and willing to work with other people. I'm really hoping for that. I'm keeping my fingers crossed, but definitely growth I have seen.
Yeah, definitely. And as a business owner, I don't own any, I don't have any employees, but if I ever do, I'm going to do my best to implement like all the things I've learned and even hear other people out. And definitely people need mental days where they can be like, okay, I don't feel whatever, or can I stay home and work? Because all of a sudden we could work at home. While all in the while, we could have done it anyway. So they were playing some games with us. Right. And so I went to a company one time to do something, and then they had a little room. It called like the meditation pod, where you can schedule for 15, 30 to 1 hour meditation, where you can just go in there and just be alone. And I was just like, wow, this is so important. And funny thing is, I asked the front desk, they said, that room is busy. People are trying to get in that room. That's how important it is.
There's been jobs I've gone into where they do yoga before the beginning of their shift. Nice. And I've seen a lot of that happening in industrial work. I have friends who work a lot. Nebraska's an agriculture and industrial state. So a lot of my friends who work in factories, you know, they're like, yeah, we did yoga before the beginning of our shift. I'm like, what? It's like, no way. And they're like, yeah. And then I've done temp jobs in factories. And sure enough, you do a little bit of yoga before you start your shift, you know, that's great. And a lot of companies, you know, are offering, you know, counseling services and on-site medical services now. And it's just definitely something that I am excited to see grow over the next few years. Definitely.
Me too. Definitely. Because they have the money, like, come on.
Like you can give us a little bit more, you know, to help you out here.
Yeah. I mean, and if your employees have well-being, then they're going to do great work for your work. So it's like, it's win-win. It's more win for you because you're making the dollars, and it's win-win because exactly. You want happy employees who want to do the work for you happily. Definitely. Mm-hmm. So,
and there's studies to show that.
Yeah. 100%. Why is it important for you to be part of those groups that we met at?
For me, it's more for the support. I want to be there to support them. I want, you know, to have support because, as I mentioned before, you know, you can have sober friends, but they will never fully understand where you're coming from. So I like to have that peer support, and I like to be there for other people. I can go to my sober friends, which is great. You know, they'll come over and distract me, whatnot. And that's great. But when it comes to talking about the nitty gritty, dirty part of addiction, that's something I don't think they would ever understand, mm-hmm. even though they could try. So I prefer to talk to other people in the same life path and, you know, just be there for each other and talk it out and, you know, connect in that way.
Right. Yeah, makes sense. So why was it important for you to tell your story today? And by the way, I feel like this conversation was flowing and is as if we knew each other. Already,
I know. I love it. Like, I'm sitting here going, I should message him at the end and see how his day's going. for me, it was important because I didn't want anyone to know they're alone. Like, I don't want them to think that just because you've been sober for 6 years and you fall off, and then you're sober for 4 years and you fall off, that doesn't mean, you know, you're not in the same boat as everybody else. Because that's something I definitely noticed in the other groups that I was in before I joined the current one we're in. Is that I got a lot of, you're not an addict, or you're not a true alcoholic, or you're not a true, you know, you can't be addicted to cannabis, you know, and if you smoke a lot, it's not an addiction, it's just an issue. And I'm like, no. And I wanted other people to know, like, just because I quit for years and then I fell off and quit again for another few years, it does not make me any less invalidate. It does not invalidate me from the experiences and my sobriety. And I wanted other people to know that if they're coming from different places, that, you know, you're still there. We're still connected. We're still going through the same thing. We still have the same goal of sobriety and mental wellness.
Yeah, I actually have been, well, because I have to, I'm preaching to the choir, and I had to like take my own preaching, if that's the line of the thing is. I had this, I think we froze. Okay, we're back. Yeah, I had this thing of, I was afraid to tell people I was addicted to sugar and candy. because I felt that people, it was in my head. No one told me that, for the record. I felt that if I mentioned that to someone who'd been 28 years smoking meth, they probably would think like, what the hell is this guy talking about? Why is he talking about addicted to sugar? And I went through meth and I went, my family died and I went to jail. Like, shut up, you know? So I was thinking that way, and I was like, no, like we all have our own special situations and no situation is lesser than the other. And I had to stop shaming myself and come out and say, you know what? I'm addicted to sugar. I kicked it out for 18 months. It took me 18 months to get out of my body. You know what forced me to do it? The fear of diabetes. And also I was starting to have candida. You know, I don't know if you know candida, HIS. And I was just like, okay, if I'm having candida, and I researched it, that's because of the excess of sugar, what's next? Diabetes. And I'm like, that was the point where I was like, nope. So it took me 18 months to get out of the craving. And yes, I do relapse. And as I mentioned, but I, of course, in the beginning, I used to beat myself down because of it. But now I'm like, the shame and guilt have no use. And I'm not going to fear of relapsing again. And I'm just going to do better. What I do is I just give to, I'm like, text my roommate. I'm like, hey, I have some extra Oreos. You want some? I mean, exactly. I guess I should ask, are you addicted first? Let me check. Like,
exactly. And it's like, it doesn't matter if you're addicted to sugar, caffeine, or the lesser low form things. In some of my books, it even says caffeine and sugar are considered a substance that you are addicted to. So you're not invalidated in any way. You are completely valid in recognizing and doing something with your addiction. And I am super proud of you for doing something like that. And, you know, I'm proud of you, even if you had bought those Oreos, you recognized what you were doing and you stopped. And that is something really awesome that not a lot of people can do, whether it's caffeine, nicotine, meth, marijuana, alcohol, whatnot. You know, if you're able to stop at that moment and realize what you're doing, it's something very awesome to be proud about.
Yeah. Thank you. And yeah, talking to people like you and doing this had helped me strengthen my non-judgment of myself and non-shame and non-guilt and non-fear, because I get so inspired by so many stories. And yeah, so I totally love this and I love this conversation. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
And you're very welcome.
And I'm so excited for you with your new career that you're working on. And I would love to hear from you once you graduate or once you start working, and or if you're doing your own studies, what you came up with. I would love to hear the progress, etc. So I kind of like was reading your shirt and I was like, ooh, I want to see more. Is that possible?
Embrace mindfulness, embrace empathy, joy, life, and happiness.
So. Embrace. I must come. That's great. That's a great shirt. And
thank you.
Yeah. I know a lot of people are in denial that your surroundings cannot influence you, what you read cannot influence you, what you drink or eat, whatever. Your surroundings, whatever it is, influence you. And wearing a great shirt like this, it influences yourself and someone else is going to read it. Mm-hmm. It influences them. It's their choice if they want to or not, but you did it for yourself and you're just inspiring. And I love that shirt. I don't know if you know the study of water, how water contains energy. And if you say water, fuck you, it will change into fuck you. Like, and if you say love you, I love you, it will change into that. Like, it's a study, like you could Google it. And it's so true. I'll have to
look that up. And, you know, and that's true, you know, about water, about plants, you know, if you start cussing and being mean to your plants, they start dying. And, you know, we're all connected, both, you know, plants, water, air, all of that, we're all connected. And it's all needs to be treated in a positive, loving way. But in a sense, also acknowledging that, you know, there is a darker side to that, that you need to balance out. And that's something I try to keep in mind every day.
Yes, definitely. I'm so grateful that you give the time to talk to me and inspire me and even giving me strength because of your story, definitely. And as you mentioned, it's something that I do when people are doing great for their lives. It adds to my joy because I'm happy for you, the things that you do. Like indirectly, you are impacting me. if that makes sense. It's like because you're doing greatness to people around you, and enough people do that, then the whole world will be great. So thank you for your work. Yeah.
You're very welcome. And thank you for having me on and asking me all those questions. Like I was nervous at first, but I was like, no, we got this. We totally got this.
Yeah, definitely.
Don't be afraid to reach out. You know, if you're struggling, there's hotlines you can call. If you are having, you know, walking into a bar, turn around and call your sponsor, call your friend, call the hotline. Just do whatever you need to do to take care of you in a responsible, healthy manner.
Yes. And I've noticed that, at least in my experience, it's easier to reach out to a stranger who has nothing to do with you. And I'm not saying your family or friends won't be, but in my experience, then my friends and family, because I guess there's that bias there, or there's that, oh my God, that's him again calling or texting or, but a stranger, for some reason, at least in my experience, they're more willing and open to even hear you, even if they're busy or whatever, just because there's a stranger, for some reason, in my experience, they're more likely to hear you out for 5 minutes or something like that. And then you, and then there's no baggage on both ends, kind of a thing too. Maybe that's what it is. You can just say your piece, they say their piece, and then, and there's no attachment to take or give because you're just done. But for your friend, there might be the attachment of like, oh, you weren't there for me, or you didn't hear me long enough, or you had to go and do whatever. And then, but a stranger. So if you cannot reach out to your family or friends, or if you like afraid, reach out to a stranger, because I know a lot of strangers have reached out to me and I never denied any of them. And now I'm reaching out to strangers because I finally accept my ability and gifts to talk to people, and I love people. So
people are great. That's what I love about people. Like, we're so intense and so different, but so open. And I love that about humans. Absolutely love it.
Yeah, there's nothing to be afraid of. I tell people, like, when I moved to New York, I'll say hello to everybody and smile, and people will be like, oh, you're weird. And let me talk to that person, run across the street because he's saying hi to me. And I was confused. And then I talked to enough people. They said, that's not normal. People might think you want something from them. I'll say hi to people and be nice. People say, what do you want from me? Or they say, I don't have money. And I used to be confused, but now I understand it psychologically and I don't take it personal. But it's so sad how we let this world teach us that if someone smiles, they need something from you. And I think, of course, the bad people ruin it for all the good people. You know, it's like someone smile at you and they snatch your purse and that sucks. And then you learn from that. But I feel like there's more good in the world than those purse snatchers.
Exactly. I feel the same way.
Yeah. All right. I'll let you go. Thank you so much for being here. All right. Thank you again. Have a good one.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me on, hon.
All right. Thank you, Sam. Bye.
Bye.